I was talking with a brother, Jason. You always have to pick the hard hymns to sing, and I ruin my voice before I start preaching, and then I can't speak. Sorry. Anyway, I was speaking with a brother here a few months ago, and he asked me about what the Bible says about suing and about having lawsuits, and if this is something that a Christian can partake of or not. And that got me thinking, and so that's why I've put together this sermon. I can't believe what you've done to my voice. Let me start off defining some terms. Lawsuit. Lawsuit is a suit in law, a prosecution of a claim in a court of law. And we're going to find not this term used in the Bible, but we're going to find the concept of this term used in the Bible. And we will find the next term, and that is to sue. It's not used very many times, but we will see this term used in the Bible. To sue is to follow a person or thing in motion, occasionally to tend cattle. So that's not really what we're talking about. But if you think about the primary definition, to follow somebody, that's what it is when you're suing somebody. You're following them to try to get back something that is owed to you, if you think about that. But let's go on down in the definition, and we'll find the definition that as it pertains to a legal matter. To institute a suit for, to make a legal claim to petition or appeal for, to seek to obtain. It says this is rare, and it tells us to go on to number 21. Before I get to 21, I'll go to number 13. To institute legal proceedings against a person, to proceed in a court of law, to bring a civil action against. And that's basically the definition that we are familiar with, and that's what I'm going to be referring to when I talk about suing somebody in this study. And then down at number 21, as the definition pointed us to, it is to make legal claim, to institute legal proceedings, to bring a suit. So what does the Bible say about lawsuits and suing? Now, some of you might think this is an unchristian thing to do. Nobody should ever sue anybody for anything. But that's not true. The Bible actually upholds the idea of suing and of lawsuits, though in the Bible it was more of a primitive affair, but I'll show you that the principle is there. The Bible teaches the principle of restitution, and we're going to see this in both New and Old Testament, the principle of restitution. This is basically what the rest of the sermon is going to be about, is showing you what the Bible has to say about this concept. Restitution is the action of restoring or giving back something to its proper owner or of making reparation to one for loss or injury previously inflicted. So when you make restitution, you restore something that was somebody else's that you have taken, either physically taken or defrauded them of or something like that. You have taken something from somebody or caused them to not get something that they should have gotten. And therefore, you have to make it right. This is what the scripture teaches. Now, if you think about it, how does this fall into the idea of lawsuits and suing them? Well, in order for restitution to occur, the plaintiff must bring the defendant before a judge for him to decide if he's broken the law and if he owes restitution or not. It has to be adjudicated by somebody. In the Old Testament, it was the judges of the land. In the New Testament, if we're in the church, then it's the church that does this, and I'll talk about that when we get to the end. But in general in life, you're not going to bring your neighbor before the Minneapolis church to adjudicate a matter, obviously. We don't have jurisdiction over them, and they're not going to submit to that. You have to take them to a civil judge, and there's nothing wrong with that, and we'll talk about that as we go through this. This was basically Absalom's campaign promise back in 2 Samuel 15 in verse 4. Now, we know Absalom was a wicked man, and he was trying to usurp the authority of David, his father, the king. What he said was good, like all politicians. They usually talk a good game. What he would have done when he got in office, I'm sure, was something totally different. Nothing's new under the sun. But look at 2 Samuel 15 and verse 4. It says, Absalom said, moreover, oh, that I were made a judge in the land, that every man which hath any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice. He's basically saying, men could bring their suits, their lawsuits, unto me, and I could decide the case and make restitution where is necessary. And that is the purpose, one of the purposes of legitimate government, to uphold the law of the land. And the law of the land should be based on true laws, God's laws, not just arbitrary laws that some guy comes up with. but laws that protect life and property and laws like that. That's what the whole purpose of the government is for. Now you say, well, our government does a whole lot more than that. Well, our government's illegitimate. The majority of what it does is illegitimate. But that's another sermon for another time. But this is the act of suing on the part of a plaintiff. This is what it means to sue. Now, Jesus used suing somebody at the law as an example of evil. But let's take a look at that before we conclude that all suing is evil. Let's look at Matthew 5, verses 39 through 40. Matthew 5, 39 through 40. Now, there is a suing that is evil. There's a couple different ways that suing could be evil. We'll talk about that in just a second. Matthew 5, 39 through 40. Jesus says, "But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." See, it's evil for somebody to smite you on one cheek, but he's saying, don't resist the evil, just give him the other one. Is it a big deal you get slapped in the face? Are you going to turn around and knock the guy out or shoot him or something? No, just say, okay, here's the other cheek too. Minor offenses like that, turn the other cheek. Verse 40, "And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also." See, Jesus is saying suing somebody at the law for the coat is evil, but it's predicated on one thing. The guy was suing him unjustly. He didn't deserve the coat. He's saying if you are sued unjustly, somebody comes after your coat and it's not his coat, and you don't owe the coat to him, just submit to the evil and give him the cloak also. You know, when the IRS sues you for 15, 20, 30% of your income, send them a little more along with it if you want to. You know, if they want to take your coat, give them your cloak also. That's what Jesus is saying here. So this instruction presupposes the innocence of the person being sued. Now, the person being sued is not always innocent, but Jesus is talking to somebody who is innocent and is being sued unjustly. That's evil, right? So it's therefore evil to sue somebody unjustly. But it's not evil to sue somebody for what is rightfully yours. If it's your coat that the guy stole and you take him to the court to get your coat back, that's not evil. And you would be suing him. You're suing him for your coat. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, if you're being sued justly, then Jesus taught to agree with thine adversary quickly before you get dragged into court and then get thrown into prison. Look in Matthew 5, 25 through 26. Just back a few verses. 25 through 26. Jesus said, "Agree with thine adversary quickly, whiles thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing." You see, he's talking about suing in both contexts. In one, he says, when you're the innocent party, if it's not a big deal, you know what? Don't even bother to go to court. It's going to cost you more to go to court and hire a lawyer. Just give him the coat and give him the cloak also and bid him on his merry way. But in the other one, in verse 25, you are in the wrong in this case. And if your adversary takes you to court and you're in the wrong, don't fight it. See if you can work it out outside of court and pay him what you owe him, lest the judge says, you know what, you're wrong, and not only are you going to pay, I'm going to send you to jail, deliver you to the officer. So in both cases, it makes sense to settle outside of court. But in one, you're the guilty party, one, you're the innocent party. So suing can be good or bad, it just depends on who is suing whom. So therefore, Jesus upheld the principle of suing for restitution. You can see it right there. Zacchaeus, likewise, recognized the ethicalness of restitution. You remember Zacchaeus in Luke chapter 19, Luke 19 and verse 8, when Zacchaeus, remember the wee little man? The wee little man was he, climbed up in a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. And when the Savior passed that way, he looked up in the tree and said, "Zacchaeus, you come down now, for I'm coming to your house today." Remember that? You ever learned the song when you were in church when you were a kid? And you just thought that I was a good, clever rhymer or something. But yeah, it's a kid's song. Anyway, we grew up singing that one. But in Luke 19, I just told you the story there. In Luke 19, in verse 8, when Zacchaeus is converted and recognizes what a sinner he is, he was a tax collector. Basically, he was an IRS agent that got converted. Whenever that happened, he says, you know what? If I have defrauded somebody, I'm going to pay back not even twice. I'm going to pay back fourfold. Luke 19 and verse 8. And Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord, Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold. Zacchaeus apparently was aware of God's method of restitution. If he stole, he's going to pay back. Now, if I remember right, and we'll see this, I think the thief had to give back double. Zacchaeus was going to go even above and beyond what God's law even required. If I've stolen anything, I'll give back fourfold. Solomon teaches that a thief would give back sevenfold. We'll get back to that. We'll get to that in just a minute. In fact, we'll get there right now. Go over to Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs 6, 30 through 31. We're going to see here that this principle of restitution is enshrined in the Proverbs. Now, the Proverbs are in the Old Testament. It is technically part of the Old Testament law, but the Proverbs, by the very nature of them, are just general observations. They are not peculiar to a law given only to a specific people, Israel. These are peculiar observations, or not peculiar, these are observations that are general among all men. These are just things that we recognize to be true, and Solomon has put them down in the Scripture for us. Proverbs chapter 6, verses 30 through 31. He says, Men do not despise a thief, if he steal to satisfy his soul when he's hungry. But if he be found, he shall restore sevenfold. He shall give all the substance of his house. Very similar to what Zacchaeus said. And we understand this principle. If a thief stole something from you, and he was stealing to stay alive, he was starving or his family was starving, you know what? I wouldn't prosecute a guy like that. I'm not going to take him to court, and he doesn't have anything, obviously, to sue him for if he's starving, but I wouldn't take him to court and put him thrown in jail. You know what? He's stealing to save his soul, to preserve his family. Okay, I would have mercy. And that's just what Solomon says that people do. But if he's found, Solomon says he'll restore sevenfold. If the law finds him, he's going to be in trouble. The law is not going to be as merciful as you or I might be. And he'll restore sevenfold, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with making him restore sevenfold. But a lot of people would have mercy in that case. Now, a proverb is a short, pithy saying in common and recognized use, a concise sentence, often metaphorical or alliterative in form, which is held to express some truth ascertained by experience or observation and familiar to all, an adage a wise saw. And I've quoted this to show you that though this is found in the Old Testament, this is not specific only to Israel. This is just a general observation that if you steal something, you restore back more than what you stole. This is just common sense. This is laws that people would come up with, even if they didn't have a revelation from God. You could just figure that out. You know what? You've stolen. Not only do you give back what you stole, because that just makes it right, but you give back more than what you stole, and then that really makes somebody whole. So since this saying is a proverb, then restitution is therefore a commonly recognized principle among men. Now, we also see restitution prior to the law of Moses. Go back to the book of Job. Job chapter 20. Job 20, 18 through 21. We're going to get to the specifics, and it's going to get neat because we're going to see all different types of, I'll call it case law or something back in the Old Testament, and we're going to see how various situations are dealt with and what types of restitution are required. And from that, well, I can extrapolate a whole bunch of neat things that really apply to our own lives today. But I want to establish that restitution is a New Testament precept. It's prior to the law of Moses, and it was also in the law of Moses. So this is something that applies to God's people throughout all time. Look at Job 20, 18 through 21. The reason I say it's prior to the law of Moses is because the book of Job was written prior to the law of Moses. You don't find references to the law of Moses in the book of Job. And you find interesting references like to dinosaurs and things like that, that it seems like it was written prior to the law of Moses, sometime after, probably shortly after the flood, but prior to Moses giving the law. Job 20 and verses 18 through 21. Let me see who actually said this. This was Zophar, Job's friend. He says, that which he labored for, talking about a wicked man, that which he labored for shall he restore, and shall not swallow it down. According to his substance shall the restitution be, and he shall not rejoice therein, because he hath oppressed and hath forsaken the poor, because he hath violently taken away an house that he builded not. Surely he shall not feel quietness in his belly. He shall not save of that which he desired. There shall none of his meat be left. Therefore shall no man look for his goods. Zophar is saying this man that stole something and took a house that was not his, he didn't build this thing, but he took it away violently, he is going to make restitution, Zophar says. So this is a principle that goes back even before the law of Moses, even before God gave the Ten Commandments. Now the law of Moses also gives much instruction about restitution. I'm going to spend most of the rest of the sermon talking about this. But before I do, I recognize we're not under the law of Moses, and that's why I'm building up to it. And I'm showing you why I'm going back to the law of Moses, to show you these laws and make application to our lives today from them. Because like I said, it's already a New Testament principle. I've already showed you that it's a New Testament principle. And we know that Old Testament laws that are repeated again in the New Testament are still valid, right? So now we can go back to the Old Testament and we can get, the New Testament just gives us the bare bones of restitution. Now we go back to the Old Testament and we get all kinds of examples of various things where restitution is made and how much. Sometimes more is required, sometimes less is required. So now this is where the Old Testament becomes useful to us today as Christians. And if we turn to Romans 15 and verse 4, we see that this is the primary use of the Old Testament for us today. It's written that we can derive learning and exhortation and admonition. Romans 15 and verse 4. Paul says, "For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope." They're written for our learning. The law of restitution, I will contend today, was written for our learning. We can learn things from those laws. Look at 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. And as a matter of fact, a lot of our laws today do hearken back to the Bible because they come from English common law, and those people were Bible reading Christian, at least Christian quote unquote people, and a lot of their laws that they instituted were just laws based on the Bible, based on God's law. So a lot of the laws that we still have down to this day, the good ones, come from God's Word. Look in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. It says, "Now all these things happen unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." So they're written for our learning, Paul tells us, but they're also written for our admonition, to admonish us, to put us in mind of things that we ought to be doing. So we can learn from these laws on restitution, be admonished by them, learn how we ought to deal with people whenever they defraud us, and learn how we can expect to be dealt with if we defraud somebody else. Let's first of all look at restitution for loss of human life due to accident or negligence. This will be the first thing that we'll look at in the law. Turn back to Exodus 21 and verse 22. Exodus 21 and verse 22. You'll find yourself, if you read back through the book of Exodus, and you'll read some of these laws, and you'll just say to yourself, I have a feeling, that just makes sense. That just seems like a good, reasonable law. I can see where if we had laws like that today, that would just make society work. Now, some of the laws were specific back then. Wearing a garment made of two types of material, or picking up sticks on Saturday, things like that. That's a different story. Those were specific laws to Israel for a specific purpose. But a lot of these laws are just good laws for men. Look at Exodus 21 and verse 22. We're going to see here if a man accidentally injured a pregnant woman while striving with another man and caused her to lose her baby, he was required to pay as the judges required. He would have to make restitution. Exodus 21 and verse 22. If men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determined. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life. whatever the mischief is, I'm not sure. But basically, the gist is, if they were striving together and somebody inadvertently hit the man's wife and she tried to break it up or something and she lost her baby and he did not mean to harm her or her baby, then he pays as the judges require. If mischief follow, whatever that means, apparently he did it on purpose or something like that, then it'd be life for life. So if he intentionally killed a woman's baby or hit her in the stomach or something, that's a different story. So there's the first example of restitution. And the husband, in this case, he would determine what the man should pay. Or the judges would determine it, but he would be punished according to what the woman's husband lay upon him. So the woman's husband would say, he owes me a certain sum of money, and the judges would determine whether that's reasonable or not, and then they would make the man pay for that loss of life. Nowadays, when this happens, it's just called a doctor, right? It's called abortion, and he does it whenever he feels like it. And there's no restitution. If a husband doesn't want it to happen, it doesn't matter. The husband ought to be able to lay restitution at a minimum on that doctor. As a matter of fact, mischief is followed. It ought to be life for life. That doctor ought to die. Let's look at verse 29. Exodus 21 and verse 29. If a man was negligent to keep a dangerous animal away from strangers, and his animal killed a man, the animal and the owner were to be put to death. Let's look at it. Exodus 21, 29. It says, but if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, and it hath been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in, but he hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner shall be put to death. If this guy had an ox, and it was wont to push, sometimes bulls are like that. They're unstable, and you get around them, and all of a sudden they just tear into you, and they'll kill you. You got to be careful around a bull. My grandfather and great-grandfather were farmers, and they had a bull that was wont to push. And my grandpa told me the story about his dad, where that bull started, you've seen it in the movies, where he kind of puts his head down and starts scratching his foot, and he came running at him. And my grandfather, rather than running and dying, ran right back at him and kicked that bull right in the snout with a heel of his boot and kind of knocked him back and stopped himself from being killed. But anyway, if you have an ox that you know does that kind of thing, and you don't keep it caged up back then, and he kills somebody, it's going to be the ox's life and your life for the life that was lost. It just drives me crazy today. Not many people have oxen anymore, but people have dogs. And people's dogs harm people, right? And I have seen numerous examples in my own life. I know people personally who have been injured by dogs that went and bit them, and then the owner justifies the dog. The owner makes excuses for the dog. Oh, well, he's temperamental. Oh, well, they went and they were trying to play with this or that. You know what? The dog ought to die. The dog ought to die. And let me tell you what. If a dog ever touches my wife or myself or my child or any innocent bystander, I will make sure the dog dies on the spot. So keep your dogs away from me and my family if they are wont to push, if you want them to stay alive. That infuriates me. I had a little cousin that was bitten in the face by a big dog of a neighbor, and they made excuses for the dog. Now, the victim's family in this case, if the ox that was wont to push killed somebody, the victim's family had the option to sue the man for a sum of money to make restitution for the slain family member instead of requiring the animal's owner's life, right? The animal's going to die regardless. See, we didn't live in a twilight zone back then. If the animal killed somebody, he's going to die. But the owner might not have to die if the family member says, you know what, you can pay us restitution for the loss of our family member. Let's look at verse 30. If there be laid on him a sum of money, that is on the owner of the ox, if there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him. And it says whatsoever. This guy is now at their mercy. They want his entire farm, his entire livelihood. They want every penny he's got. You know what? They deserve it. Because you didn't keep caged up your ox, which you knew was a dangerous animal, and it killed somebody's son. And now you're going to pay. That's what this verse says. That's called restitution. That would be taking somebody to court and suing them for their animal killing your family member. Nothing wrong with that. This principle applied to a son or daughter who is gored as well. Let's look at verse 31. Whether he have gored a son or have gored a daughter, according to this judgment shall it be done unto him. So it doesn't matter if it was a man or a woman, son, daughter, that would be the judgment. Now, if the animal killed a slave, then the restitution was a set amount, 30 shekels of silver. Let's look at verse 32. If the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Even if it was a slave, the ox was still killed. The ox is not off the hook. But the owner, it would not be his life. They wouldn't even have an option to take his life. If it was a slave, he would be fined a set amount, 30 pieces of silver. And that's just the way it was. They did not consider a slave's life to be worth what a free man's life was. And that's the way that they saw it. Now, the amount sued for would have differed according to the estimation of the worth of a man or a woman or a child. And the Bible does talk about estimating the value of somebody. Now, whether you like this or not, it doesn't really matter, but the Bible does talk about estimating the value of people. I know the Founding Fathers said all men are created equal, but God says, hey, they're worth different amounts based on their age and their sex. So take it or leave it. Actually, no, you can't. Just take it, because that's what God says. Leviticus 27 and verse 1 through 8. Leviticus 27 and verses 1 through 8. And I'll give you some examples of why one person is, quote, worth more than another. And you'll totally get what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about moral worth. I'm not talking about that. But I'll show you what I'm talking about, and you'll probably agree with me. And if you don't, I'll pray that God reveals even that unto you. Leviticus 27, 1 through 8. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when a man shall make a singular vow, and persons shall be for the Lord by thy estimation. And thy estimation shall be of the male from 20 years old even unto 60 years old. Even thy estimation shall be 50 shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary. And if it be a female, then thy estimation shall be 30 shekels. And if it be from 5 years old even unto 20 years old, then thy estimation shall be of the male 20 shekels and of the female 10 shekels. But if it be from a month old even unto 5 years old, then thy estimation shall be of the male 5 shekels of silver, and for the female thy estimation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if it be from 60 years old and above, if it be a male, then thy estimation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. If he be poorer than thy estimation, then he shall present himself before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to his ability. That vowed shall the priest value him. So we see here that basically it goes, men are worth more than women as far as this estimation goes, and people that are in their middle age and their prime are worth more than older people, and then the older people are even worth more than the younger people. And if you want to think about it just economically, it makes sense. A man in his prime can earn a lot of money. He's probably got a family to support, and he's worth a lot. Right? The woman is important, but she's not the breadwinner. If the man's gone, she's going to be destitute trying to provide for the needs of the family. Right? So you can see how a man in his middle age is worth more. An older man is not worth as much. He can't work as much. He can't work as hard. A younger child is not worth as much. They can't work as hard. They will eventually get to be, but at the time they're not worth as much. Now if you think about it, even today, let's just use Jason and I as an example. Jason's worth more than I am. Now, morally, that's debatable, and who knows about that? You know, you'd have to be the decider of that. But as far as economically, he's worth more than I am because he's got 7 kids and a wife to provide for. So if somebody bumps off Jason, how much restitution are they going to have to pay? A lot, right? Because he needs a lot of money for the next 18 years to provide for that whole clan back there, right? He's worth a lot. Now, me, on the other hand, I'm not worth that much because I only have one person to provide for. Somebody bumps me off, I'm going to be worth like an eighth of what Jason's worth because he's got eight people to provide for and I've only got one. Now, back when I was single, I was worth next to nothing. I mean, because you bump me off, what am I worth? I'm not worth anything. You know, nobody's gonna lose anything, right? So I'm just, you know, single people are not worth as much as married people. Married people aren't worth as much as those that have kids, if you want to think about it in economic terms. I'm not talking about morally, and I'm not talking about how you're standing before God and how much He loves you or anything like that. But economically, yeah, Jason's worth a lot more than I am. So if you're going to accidentally kill somebody, you better accidentally kill me, because you're going to have to pay a lot more if you accidentally kill him, because he's got a lot of people to provide for.
Amen.
This would be the modern day equivalent of suing for damages to oneself or one's family. And you see it. The ox gores somebody and you sue the guy for loss of life. Or even if they didn't kill him, you'd still, I assume there would be something that you would be able to get restitution for that harm and injury. So there's nothing wrong with suing for damages to yourself or to your family. Let's look at restitution for loss of property due to negligence. Go back to we're going to look at verse 33 of Exodus 21. Exodus 21, 33 through 34. Exodus 21, 33 through 34. We're going to see here that if a man dug a pit and didn't cover it, and another man's animal fell into it, the negligent man would be required to give money unto the other man for the life of his animal. So if you do something negligently, not something that was completely out of your power, but if you do something, you dig a hole and you don't cover it up, maybe you forgot, you're going to be in trouble if somebody gets hurt in that hole. Exodus 21, 33 through 34. And if a man shall open a pit, or if a man shall dig a pit, and not cover it, and an ox or an ass fall therein, the owner of the pit shall make it good and give money unto the owner of them, and the dead beast shall be his. So if I dig a pit and I forget to cover it up, and somebody's ox falls into the pit, I get to keep the dead ox, and if I get it in time, I might be able actually to eat the thing or something, but I got to pay him for that ox. And I can't say, well, you know, it was your dumb ox's fault. He should have been watching where he was going. He's the one that walked into the pit. No, that was negligence on my part. Or another example, if a man lets his fire get out of control and it burns up another guy's property, he's got to make restitution for that. If you start a fire, you better contain that fire. Now, all of you city slickers around here, you don't start fires. And so, well, I guess you could in the backyard and maybe burn up the whole, your neighbor's whatever, garage or something like that. But in the country, sometimes people start fires, and they do it for a reason. They might burn a field, and I had neighbors that would do that, burn a whole field, and there's a reason for that, an agricultural reason for that. But that thing gets out of control and goes and burns up 500 acres of the neighbor's woods or something, guess what? You're going to be paying a lot of restitution. Let's look at Exodus 22 and verse 6. Exodus 22 and verse 6. If a fire break out and catch in thorns, so that the stacks of corn, or the standing corn, or the field be consumed therewith, he that kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. You're going to pay for all that corn. How much ever that costs, how much ever money that farmer would have been able to sell it for, you got to pay him for it, because you were negligent and didn't watch your fire. Now, if lightning struck on your property and it started a fire and it burned over into somebody else's property, no restitution. You weren't negligent. It was not in your control. And I'll show you examples of things that are not in your control that you don't have to pay for here momentarily. This would be the modern day equivalent of suing for damages to one's property. Nothing wrong with that, right? The guy's fire burns up your property, you can sue for the cost of that property. Or the guy leaves his hole open and your ox or your ass falls into it, you can sue for the cost of the ox or the ass. I mean, if the state doesn't take care of the roads and they leave a great big pothole and it rips the wheel off your car, you would be within your rights to sue the state for the cost of the wheel of your car. Nothing wrong with that. And I don't know how that would go for you. Typically, the state never does anything wrong and they don't admit guilt, so you probably would be screwed. But you would be within your rights to sue them for it. Let's look at the restitution for theft of property. Turn back to Exodus 22. We're going to look at verse 1. So if a man stole an animal, he had to restore the owner additional animals in kind depending on the type of animal that was stolen. And this is where it gets a little bit dicey. And you might wonder, well, this is kind of weird. Why is there differences? But I'm going to show you, and we're going to extrapolate some things out of here, and you're going to see some neat stuff. So restitution for an animal that was stolen and then killed or sold. We're going to look at that one first. So if you had an oxen that was stolen, you had to make restitution of 5 oxen. Exodus 22 and verse 1. It says, if a man shall steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. Okay, so you steal an ox, you got to pay back 5 ox. If you steal a sheep, you have to restore 4 sheep. Now, why would you have to restore 5 oxen for 1 oxen, but 4 sheep for 1 sheep? Why would that be? Well, the oxen would command a higher restitution price because they are primarily work animals. In other words, they're producer goods or capital goods. They are things that you use to produce wealth, right? And also, they are also consumer goods. They're used for food. So they're both producer goods and consumer goods. And I know I'm talking in the language of Austrian economics, but it's another one of my hobbies, so I get a chance to do that once in a while. So the oxen is both. It produces things, but it also can be used for consumption, to consume it for your own food. So it commands a higher price, 5 times. Because if you kill an oxen just to restore the oxen, the guy might be without an oxen for a while, right? And he might be without all of the future labor that that oxen could produce for him. So you have to give him more oxen to make up for that. Now the sheep commands a lower restitution price because they're primarily used for food and clothing, consumer goods, right? They're not producer goods as much as they are consumer goods. So they still command more than they were worth because the sheep keeps making wool for your clothes. It keeps making milk to eat or something like that. So it's still worth more than just the cost of itself. But it's not worth as much as the oxen because the oxen can do a lot of work for you. It can pull the plow. It can create all of your crops. And it can do a lot more than the sheep could. So a person, therefore, can be sued for a higher sum for the theft of a producer good, such as manufacturing equipment, which is used to make money, or maybe tractors or tools or computers or something that you could use to make money with. You could sue somebody for a higher amount for stealing that from you than you could if you had a diamond necklace stolen from you. Because a diamond necklace is just valuable in and of itself. It doesn't produce you anything. Having that diamond necklace, it's not going to increase in value, more than likely, and it doesn't produce any additional wealth for you. Whereas the tractor or the computer or the tools or whatever, those things produce more wealth. So therefore, you could sue for a higher amount for those things. This is the law that is the basis for suing for an amount that would cover loss of future revenue. So when you, if somebody, let's say they destroyed your car and you couldn't go to work for a week or a month, they don't just pay you the $10,000 for the car that they stole or destroyed. They have to pay you for the week or months of work that you lost because you didn't have the car. You see, you get paid more than the value of the thing. Or if somebody broke your leg, they don't just pay for your doctor's bills, they pay for all of the lost work that you would have been able to accomplish if you didn't have the broken leg. This is the principle that we can extract from this, you see? See, it makes sense. Let's look at restitution for an animal that was stolen and recovered alive. So in this case, an animal gets stolen, but it's not sold, and it's not killed, and you get the animal back. So if a stolen ox or sheep was recovered alive, then the thief only had to restore double what he stole. Look at verse 4, Exodus 22 and verse 4. If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall restore double. So if he stole the ox and killed it or sold it and you didn't get it back, he had to restore 5. But if he stole the ox and you got it back, then he only had to restore 2. He only had to restore double, plus the one you lost. So you get the one back, plus you get 2 more. Now, why would it be less in that case? Well, the original, this is the way I reason it anyway, the original animal would have been restored also, and it would have been more valuable to the owner than a different animal, hence the lower restitution price. So your own ox that you already know, and you know his temperament, you know how to use him, you know what his capabilities are, he's worth more to you than another ox or maybe another couple of oxen. So you don't get five oxen, you only need two because the original one that you got back is worth two or three more. That's the way that I view it anyway. Plus, you were made whole, so you don't need to be restored as much because you got back your original thing, but you still should be paid back lost revenue in the time that it took to get the animal back or something like that. And plus, the thief should be made to pay. He should just be punished for stealing it, and part of that is restoring you two oxen back. Now, if the thief couldn't pay restitution, he'd be sold into slavery, and he'd pay that debt. Exodus 22 and verse 3. Exodus 22 and verse 3. If the sun be risen upon him, that is, the thief, there shall no blood be shed for him, for he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. So if he's caught, he's got to make the restitution. If he says, you know what, I don't have anything, I can't pay, they don't say, oh, well, okay, you're off the hook then. You don't have anything. Sorry, you filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy and you don't pay. No, there's no Chapter 7 bankruptcy in the Bible, right? You are sold as a slave if you can't pay your debts. And let me tell you what, there would be a lot less profligate spending and a lot less wild debt in this country if people were sold for slaves when they couldn't pay it. I think we all agree on that one. And I, for one, am totally in favor of that. I think that's a great law myself. Now, if a man let his beast feed in another man's field or vineyard, the other man could sue him for restitution, and he would have to give him the best out of his own field or vineyard. So if you think, you know what, I'm going to let my beast feed over in this guy's field instead of eating my own pasture, and then you just say, oh, well, you know, he just wandered over there, I didn't realize what happened. No, you're going to pay restitution for that, the Bible says. Exodus 22 and verse 5. If a man shall cause a field or a vineyard to be eaten, or shall put out or put in his beast and shall feed in another man's field of the best of his own field, and of the best of his own vineyard shall he make restitution. So if you let your ox go over there and eat in his field, you're going to provide the best out of your field to make up for it. You're not going to give him the refuse. You're not going to give him the gleanings that are left over. You're going to give the best to him. So, once again, if you took something that was your neighbor's and used it, maybe you go over there and just decide to borrow his lawnmower when he's not around or something, guess what? You're going to provide something back to him that makes up for it. All the lost gas, maybe some money for the wear and tear on his lawnmower, maybe your lawnmower for his or something like that. That would be a fair deal. All right, let's look at restitution for property lost while in one's care. So what if you loan something to somebody, either loan it to them, well, we'll get to the loaning thing next, but what if you deliver something to somebody to watch over for you and to take care of and make sure nothing happens to it, and then what happens if it gets stolen or it gets destroyed or something like that? Then we're going to see what the Scripture tells us to do in that case. So if a neighbor was keeping money or things for a man and it was stolen from him, the thief, if found, would pay double. Exodus 22 and verse 7. If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it shall be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. So if a guy is watching your money for you and a thief comes and steals it, if the thief is found, the guy that was watching the money, he's going to be okay. He doesn't have to pay anything. The thief is going to pay the double, right? So if you put your money in the bank and a bank robber comes along and steals the money, the bank robber would have to pay double. But if the bank stole the money through inflation, they should have to pay back restitution, right? They should, whenever they deliver you your money in 10 years and it buys, you know, maybe only 80% of what it did when you put it in, they should have to make restitution. We'll talk about that. But of course, that's not going to happen. Now, if the thief was not found, then the man could take his neighbor to court and have the judges decide if he stole the goods himself. And if he stole them, he would have to pay double. So you give the money to your neighbor to watch over for you. And then you come back and you want the money, and he's like, I don't know what happened to it, it's just gone, right? Well, then you take him to court, and they do an investigation, and they find out, did the man that was watching it for you, did he actually steal it or not? If they determine that he stole it, then he is the thief, and he pays the double. Exodus 22:8-9. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he have put his hand to his neighbor's goods. In other words, whether he stole the stuff that he was supposed to be watching out for. Kind of like the Social Security Trust Fund. We're going to watch out for this money for you, and then they steal it and pillage it and put IOUs in there. I'm not in favor of the whole Social Security system anyway, but you know what they did was wrong whenever they stole out of it and put IOUs in there. They ought to pay restitution, except they're the government and they don't have any money. The only way that they can pay it is to rob somebody else to pay you for it. So just get rid of the program altogether is what I say. Now, if a neighbor was keeping animals for a man and they died or were hurt or were driven away, no man seeing it, then the neighbor would take an oath before God that he did not steal them, and he would not have to pay restitution. You see, this is where the law of God is fair, because if he was watching this stuff and it was completely out of his control and he didn't do anything to lose it, then he does not have to pay. Exodus 22:10-11. It says, if a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, and it die or be hurt or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of the Lord be between them both, and that he hath not put his hand to his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. So you give him your ox or your ass, and you go back to get it, and he says, the thing, you know, a wolf came by and killed it, or an animal drove it away, or a thief came by and stole it, and I swear to the Lord this is the case, and I did not steal this, and I did everything in my power to keep it safe, then he does not have to pay. He does not have to pay. So in the case, if you put your money in the bank and a bank robber comes and steals the money and they don't catch the bank robber and the bank did everything that they could to keep that money safe, then in this system, they would not pay. That's the risk you take to have somebody else store your goods for you. If they store your goods, there is an implicit risk there that they might lose it for you. Just like there's an implicit risk that you might lose it yourself if you kept it at your own house. So there is a risk there. And if the person did everything reasonable to protect it, they don't have to pay. Now, if the owner stole the animals, then restitution was required. Verse 12. And if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. So if it was stolen, then he's got to make the restitution. Or if he stole the animals, pardon me, he makes the restitution. Now, if the animals had been killed by a wild beast, then the remains were to be presented and he would have to pay. Or he would not have to pay, pardon me. Let's look at verse 13. If it be torn in pieces, then let him bring for a witness, and he shall not make good that which was torn. So, out of his control, an animal comes in. He had erected a nice fence, but somehow the animal jumped the fence or climbed under it or something and killed the animal that he was watching. If that's the case, he does not have to pay. He produces the body so that they know he just didn't steal it and go sell it or something. And then he's absolved from it. Now, the law of Moses did not allow, we see, for suing someone for something that was out of their control as long as it was not due to negligence. So if you didn't have control of the situation, you would not be sued for it. Okay, for instance, if you go to a doctor to get an operation, and he does the operation, and he didn't do anything wrong, he didn't amputate the wrong leg or something like that, it's just a dangerous operation, it was a risky business, and he did his best, but you died on the table. You don't sue that doctor, right? You don't sue the doctor. If you go to the doctor, and they did everything that they could, and then something happens, and the surgery is botched, and it wasn't their fault, right? Then the Bible would say that they don't get sued if they did everything that they could. And it wasn't due to negligence or something like that. If it was due to negligence, different story. Then you can sue them, and you can sue them to make it right. And whatever lost time and work and all that, you would be in your rights to sue them if it was due to negligence or if they just flat out intentionally did something wrong. Now let's look at one more case. Restitution for damaged property that was borrowed. So, and we can all put ourselves in this situation, what if you borrow something from your neighbor? Maybe you borrow your neighbor's chainsaw and you're out there sawing with it and you break it. Something happens to it. You're just sawing along and all of a sudden the thing breaks. Oh, great. I just borrowed something and now it broke. What's the right thing to do? Just hand it back and say, oh, sorry about your luck, buddy. I didn't do it. Is that the right thing to do? Not according to the word here. If a man borrowed an animal from his neighbor, and while he was using it without the owner present, it was hurt or killed, then he would have to replace the animal. Exodus 22 and verse 14. And if a man borrow aught of his neighbor, and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof, being not with it, he shall surely make it good. So he's going to make it good. In other words, you're going to give back the same chainsaw that you borrowed. You borrow that chainsaw and you break it, you're going to pay to have it fixed and return it to him whole. You're going to make it good for him. You just don't give it back and say, well, hey, it was bound to break anyway. That's not how it's supposed to work. Now, if it was something where, you know, you got the thing, you borrowed it when it was smoking and it was on its last leg and you knew it was going to break or something, then that's a different story. But if you borrowed it in good order, then it ought to be returned in the same condition that you borrowed it. Now, if the owner was with the man when the animal was hurt or killed, or if the owner hired the man to use it, then no restitution was to be made. Look at verse 15. But if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. If it be an hired thing, it came for his hire. So if your neighbor comes over and brings his chainsaw along, and the two of you are cutting up a tree in your yard, and you're using his chainsaw, and he's right there, and he can see what you're doing, and all of a sudden, just boom, it just dies. He doesn't say, well, you got to fix that. No, he's with you. He saw everything that happened. He knows you weren't misusing it, and that's just, hey, tough luck, right? You don't have to pay restitution. Or if he hired you and said, hey, here's my chainsaw. I'm going to pay you $50. Go and saw up that log in my yard. And his chainsaw dies when you've been hired to use it. You don't pay restitution. You didn't do any, you know, that's the price of him hiring you to do the work for him. And I'd say even in this case, maybe you weren't super careful with it and you'd put the thing into a stone or something and ruin the blade on it or something. But you know what? That's the price of hiring somebody. You hire them, you give them your tools, and if they break it, well, that's just what happens. That happens at work, right? I mean, you hire somebody to do something and they do something stupid and break something. Guess who pays for it? The employer pays for it. That's just the cost of doing business. And that's totally consistent with what the scripture says here. So the law of Moses therefore allowed for suing someone for the price of something that was damaged or destroyed while being borrowed. So the guy would have the right to take somebody to court if he loans you his chainsaw and you break the chainsaw when you're using it and then just want to give it back broken. He could take you to small claims court and sue you for the price of the chainsaw, the price to get it fixed. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, whether it is prudent to do so, I'm not saying that just because you can sue, you should sue. It just depends. Am I going to go to small claims court over a chainsaw that's going to cost me $50 to fix? No, I'm not. It's not worth it. It's like what Jesus taught, turn the other cheek, you know, turn the other chainsaw. Don't worry about it. But you could, and you would not be sinning to do so if you did take somebody to small claims court for that. Okay, so let's take it down to ourselves here. When can a Christian sue? Well, a brother in the church should not take another brother in the church to civil court, but he should rather take the matter to the church and let them decide it. So there's a difference. There's one set of rules here for people when you're dealing with people in the world, and there's another set when you're dealing with people in the church. So if you're dealing with people in the church, you don't take them to small claims court. Bring it before the church. If you, Steve, if you loan Jason your chainsaw and he breaks your chainsaw, and which is altogether believable, right? If that would happen, then you wouldn't take him to small claims court. You'd take it before the church and say, I loaned Jason my chainsaw, he broke it, and he should pay me restitution for it. And the church would say, yep, totally believable. We don't even need to see the evidence. We can see that happening. And therefore, Jason, pay him the $50. And that's what we do. We would have our own little courtroom set up here. And I will read you the verses that say that. 1 Corinthians 6, 1 through 8. 1 Corinthians 6, 1 through 8. Paul says, "Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints?" See, you're going to take somebody to small claims court before some pagan heathen when you could come before the church and have the church decide it? Paul says, no, you don't go before the heathen. You take it before the church. "Do you not know that the saints shall judge the world? And if the world be judged by you, shall be judged by you, are ye unworthy to judge the smallest matters?" I mean, if we're going to judge the world, we're going to take part in the judgment at the resurrection, certainly we can judge about a chainsaw dispute, can't we? I mean, think about it. Reasoning from the greater to the lesser. "Know ye not that we should judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? If then ye have judgments of things pertaining to this life, set them to judge who are least esteemed in the church." And that means, without getting into all of it, that means non-pastors. Pastors are said to be highly esteemed. Those who are least esteemed would be non-pastors. We're not talking about, you know, taking a poll to find out who is the lowliest member of the church or something like that. And we're not talking about the most simple-minded or anything like that either, because the next verse tells us that we ought to pick a wise man. He says, "I speak to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you? No, not one that shall be able to judge between his brethren. So if we would have a church court situation, we wouldn't say, "Oh, least esteemed, let's pick the youngest member of the congregation, or the guy that has the least experience, or the guy that everybody doesn't think much of," or something like that. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to pick somebody who's not a pastor, and we're going to pick somebody who's a wise man and can make good decisions. And then he can, or they can, pick a few people and they can judge it. "But brother goeth to law with brother, and that before the unbelievers. Now therefore there is utterly a fault among you, because ye go to law one with another. Why do ye not rather take wrong? Why do ye not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? Nay, ye do wrong and defraud, and that your brethren." Why don't you just suffer yourselves to be defrauded? Instead of going before the heathen to have them decide some trivial matter, just suffer yourself to be defrauded. Just say, "You know what? Okay, Jason broke the chainsaw, but you know what? I'm not taking him to small claims court, and I don't even feel like bringing it before the church. This is petty. You know what? Forget about it. I'll fix the chainsaw myself. No big deal." Or if Jason broke it, he would just fix it anyway, right? He'd just give you the money, and it wouldn't be a dispute. But if for some reason it was a dispute and you just had to have it adjudicated, bring it before the church. Don't bring it before the unbelievers. Now, after hearing the case, the church could decide that restitution is owed. And that would be how we would go about it. We would basically review this sermon, review the scriptures that we looked at in this sermon, and we would determine what kind of offense it was and what type of restitution should be determined. And we've got the rule book, the law book right here. This is all we need. In that case, the brother must abide by the ruling of the church. And if he doesn't abide by the ruling of the church, then in that case he'd be put out of the church, because he'd be at variance with the church. If you look in Matthew 18, 15 through 17, the church does have an enforcement mechanism. You see, the law, the state has their enforcement mechanism, and they'll throw you in jail or they'll, you know, whatever, take your life or your liberty or whatever. The church, we can't do that, but we do have an enforcement mechanism. If you don't abide by the ruling of the church and you don't accept that, then you're at variance with the church and you'll be put out of the church. Matthew 18, 15 through 17. "Moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone, and if he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. But if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it unto the church. And if he neglect to hear the church, let him be unto thee as an heathen man and a publican." So based on the biblical principles that have been shown, it's permissible for a Christian to sue for restitution. There's nothing wrong with that under conditions. This would include suing for things like loss of life, whether intentional or owing to neglect. So if your family member is killed, by somebody intentionally killing them or neglectfully killing them, such as a doctor or such as any situation, anything that happens where a person is killed, they didn't, you know, fence off their high voltage wires or something, and you walked over into their yard and got electrocuted or something like that. Or they had a, like my dad used to have this drill, a steel case drill. This thing was outright dangerous. My brother almost electrocuted him with it. If my dad would have had that steel case drill laying out and some neighbor kid would have picked that thing up and started drilling with it in the garage and got electrocuted, my dad could have had to pay restitution and should pay restitution for that kid getting electrocuted. So you want to be careful what you allow to be just laying around where people can get access to it. Or guns. If you leave a loaded gun laying on your kitchen table and some kid walks up and shoots himself with it, guess what? You're going to pay restitution. Now, I'm not opposed to guns. I'm totally in favor of guns, but you got to be careful with them. And if you got small kids, teach them to not touch them when you're not around. And if they're really small, make sure you keep them where they can't get a hold of them. And when they get a little bigger, you just teach them, you don't touch these guns. When I grew up, we had guns in the house, loaded guns, ammunition all over the place from the time I was a little kid, and it just wasn't an issue. We didn't touch those guns without my dad's permission. He didn't have to lock them all up and keep the ammo separated and all that. You just have to teach them you don't touch those things. And if you have kids' friends over, that's when you really got to be careful, because the friends might not know the family rules, so you got to make sure that's crystal clear, and then you might want to put them away because their kids might not obey you like your kids should. This could also include a loss of future earning potential due to death or injury. And the scripture allows for this. If something happens and you break your leg due to somebody else's negligence, or a doctor botches a surgery like happened to your mother-in-law or something like that, and it was due to negligence and they didn't do what they should have, not mother-in-law, but stepmother, then you are within your rights to sue for restitution to make up for lost income that you would have been able to make had the injury not happened, or the death. This would also include loss of property due to being stolen or destroyed. So if somebody steals your property, ruins your property, you have a right to sue for restitution to make that right. Now, I'm not saying in all these cases you must or you even should. I'm just saying you can, and your discretion should prevail as to whether you want to sue somebody and you want to go through the headache of it or not. Now, let's look at when a Christian should not sue. There's no example that I can find of suing for pain and suffering in the Bible, and therefore a Christian should seriously consider not doing so. I'm not saying you can't sue for pain and suffering, and you could make a case for that possibly, but I don't see an example of that in the scripture. And personally, I don't think I would sue for pain and suffering, because you can't really quantify pain and suffering anyway and say, well, I suffered $10,000 worth of suffering or something. You can say I missed $10,000 worth of work. You can't say I suffered $10,000 worth of suffering. So I would seriously consider not doing that, because it's because of stuff like that in this society where people sue for these crazy amounts of money because of pain and suffering, that medical expenses are so expensive, for one thing. That's the government's got more to do with it than that, but that's part of the reason why medical expenses are so high, because doctors have to carry such crazy amounts of insurance to be able to pay out for these frivolous lawsuits. Since restitution is defined as the action of restoring or giving back something to its proper owner, or of making reparation to one for loss or injury previously inflicted, it is therefore unbiblical to sue for exorbitant amounts of money that surpass the value of the actual loss or of the loss of future earning potential. So if you break your leg and you miss a month's work, it is wrong for you to sue for $1 million. Unless you happen to be the CEO of 3M and you make that much in a month or something. But it's wrong for you to sue for an amount that far and exceeds the actual loss you incurred and the loss of productivity that would have ensued had you not been injured. It's not scriptural. Now, you could sue, remember the five times. You know, you lost one oxen, you get five more. Okay, so if you, maybe you lose, your car example or something like that. Somebody destroys your car, you get back the price of the car and maybe five times the price of the car or something like that. You could do that. I mean, that, you're within your rights to do something like that, but not exorbitant amounts of money, which would far and exceed anything that you could have possibly lost. And I personally would just sue for whatever I lost. Just make it right for me. I wouldn't even do the five times. Just make it right for me. If I lost working time, then make that right for me. But other than that, I wouldn't sue for any more. We should not sue someone if we were at fault or if we were negligent. For instance, if you burn yourself on hot coffee at McDonald's, and I'm sure we've all heard that story, you don't sue somebody because you are an idiot. If you burn yourself with coffee, you don't sue somebody else. Now, I know there's more to that story, and I know that McDonald's put out some kind of a mandate that to make the coffee extra super hot so that it took a long time to cool down so that people wouldn't get a refill. And I know all that stuff, but still, coffee's hot, right? Everybody knows that coffee's hot. If you burn yourself with coffee, you don't sue, and you don't sue for millions of dollars. That just makes sense. Or if you hurt yourself while trespassing on somebody else's property, you don't sue them. You know, if you just happen to want to borrow your neighbor's car for a while and you smash out the window to go and open the thing up and you cut yourself, you don't sue your neighbor for something that you caused. Or if you're just walking around on his property or something and you trip on a trip line that he set up to catch thieves, you don't sue if you were doing something wrong, if you were trespassing. Swimming in their pool. Yep, exactly. You drown in your neighbor's pool, you do not sue the neighbor for that. Now, if your neighbor had an in-ground pool with no fence around it and your child wandered over there and fell into it or something, then maybe you'd have a case because he didn't do anything to protect that pool from a child possibly wandering over there. So that would be an example where you could sue for restitution. But if your neighbor invites your kids over to swim and your kid drowns in his pool, as long as he was there watching over the situation, doing what a parent should do, you don't sue him for something like that. It wasn't his fault. We should not sue someone for something that was out of his control. For example, if a tree falls on you while you're standing in your neighbor's yard, you don't sue him for that. Now, if he knew the tree's ready to fall or something like that and he didn't bother to tell you, that's different. But sometimes trees just fall or limbs fall off of trees and you're standing in your neighbor's yard and a big limb falls off and conks you on the head and you die. You don't sue somebody for that because he had no control over that. And that's what we saw that the scripture taught, that very thing. Or you hurt yourself while riding your neighbor's four-wheeler or something. You don't sue your neighbor because you hurt yourself on his four-wheeler. That was your fault. Now you want to count the cost before suing someone. Turn with me to Luke chapter 14. If you decide to go that route, and if you have a legitimate case, it doesn't mean that because you can, you should. You want to seriously consider this, especially today with how much lawyer fees and all that cost and how much of a headache it is. Luke 14, verses 31 through 32. And remember, a lot of times if you take somebody to court to sue them, especially if you lose, you're going to pay your own lawyer bills, and you're maybe, depending on the state, you may pay their lawyer bills too. So you better count the cost. Luke 14, 31 through 32. Or what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage and desireth conditions of peace. Maybe you were unjustly fired at work and you work for a great big Fortune 500 company and you're going to take them to court, or you were mistreated or something or whatever. Well, you know what? You better consider that if you, with your, how much was it? 10,000, go up against them with their 20,000 attorneys, you might want to consider the cost. And it might just be a better idea to go get another job. Why would you want to get your job back from a company that treated you like garbage anyway? Just an example. Now, if the offense was minor, like Jesus taught, we want to let it go. Let's read that again in Matthew chapter 5, 39 through 42. And furthermore, that was kind of a bad example because I believe in at-will employment anyway, and your employer should be able to fire you anytime he wants for anything because he doesn't owe you a job and you don't have any claim on a job. You only have claim for a paycheck that you worked to earn. And once he's paid you your paycheck, he doesn't owe you anything. So I don't think you should be suing your employer anyway. But anyway, Matthew 5:39-42. And I say, but I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh of thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. So this is just a good instruction here to consider how serious something is, and just to let minor offenses go. When Jesus says to resist not evil, he's not saying that if you're walking down an alley and some thief jumps out and puts a knife to your wife's throat or something, that you just say, well, hey, nothing I can do about it, go ahead. No, you kill the guy, right? This is a different story. He's talking about minor offenses. Somebody slaps you on the face, no big deal. Don't pull out your gun, don't punch him back, just give him the other cheek. He tells you when he makes you go a mile with him, say, you know what, this isn't right, but I'll just go too. Not a big deal. He wants to take your coat, okay, take my cloak also, buddy. No big deal. He wants to take your house so that you're going to be homeless, that's a different story, right? You got to provide for your own. Jesus is talking about minor offenses, and when they're minor, just let them go. The better man will just let it go. He'll suffer himself to be defrauded. It's not worth the time, not worth the energy. But on the other hand, if it's major, don't let yourself be destroyed because you refuse to do judgment. Look at Proverbs 21:7. Proverbs 21:7. There is a time to fight. You just got to figure out when that time is. Proverbs 21:7. It depends on how you look at this verse. You could read it either way. And I tend to look at it the way that I'm going to apply it here. But you could apply it to either the wicked that is doing the robbery or the righteous person that is being robbed. I'm going to apply it to the righteous person that's being robbed. And if you don't like that application, then don't use that verse to prove this point. But it says, the robbery of the wicked shall destroy them because they refuse to do judgment. You see, you got the wicked and then you get the people that are being robbed. And the application that I'm making is that the robbery, if the person being robbed, in this case, there'd be a wicked person being robbed. If the person being robbed doesn't do judgment, the robbery will destroy them, you see? So if somebody comes and robs you and you are just so weak and pathetic that you won't even stand up for yourself, and you let them take your house, you let them take your whole livelihood, you're going to be destroyed because you wouldn't do judgment, you see? Now, you could run it the other way, too, that the wicked themselves are going to be destroyed because they won't judge themselves and not rob people. So you could look at it, like I said, you could look at it either way. I'm looking at it in the way that the person being robbed is actually a wicked man because he refuses to do judgment when God says you ought to do judgment. So that's the way that I'm applying that one. Now, if you are being sued and you are in the wrong, then try to settle out of court before the situation turns from bad to worse. Let's look at Luke 12:58-59. This will be the last verse. Luke 12:58-59. And it just depends. I mean, if you're being sued for your entire livelihood, you don't have a choice. But if you're being sued for something relatively minor, even if it's going to hurt, is it worth it to miss the work to go to court? Is it worth it to deal with all the lawyers? Is it worth it? And especially, in this case, if you are in the wrong, for goodness sakes, don't fight it. If you're in the wrong, unless they're trying to take you for everything you're worth and you only really owe them, you know, $1,000 or something, if you're in the wrong, you pay. As long as they are getting from you what is deserved to them, you pay and don't fight it. Luke 12:58-59. Jesus says, when thou goest with thine adversary to the magistrate, as thou art in the way, give diligence that thou mayest be delivered from him, lest he hale thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and the officer cast thee into prison. I tell thee that thou shalt not depart thence till thou hast paid the very last mite. This presupposes your guilt, right? You're going to be judged as guilty. But I'd say, even if it Even if it looks like it could go either way and you think you're in the right, if you can settle outside of court, settle outside of court. Don't take it to court and risk losing all and risk losing the case and risk paying your lawyer bills and his lawyer bills and the restitution he's asking for. Just settle outside of court if you can and be wise like the Son of God taught. So anyway, I hope that that helps you to have a better understanding of in your mind of when you can sue and when you can and when you should sue and when you shouldn't.